Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Criminal Law Presents CAF Chats. I am Major Dustin Morgan, and I'm joined today for the first time on this podcast by Major Corey Squires. Corey, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Major Morgan. Of course, excited to be here, and although a little nervous about the case we have to talk about and the unusual set of facts before us today.
Yeah, good point. So before we start today, I know typically we deal with rather adult topics because we're dealing with crimes at the end of the day. I'm just going to put a proviso out that today's a little bit more adult than usual. So if you have any children around, this might not be the one to listen to because we do have to get into some specifics to be able to talk about the case in depth. So with that, today we're going to talk about United States versus Rocha. This is a case that was argued on the 25th of October, 2023 and decided on May 8th, 2024. Corey, why don't you tell us a little bit about the facts here in Rocha?
Sure. So as you said before, there's not really a way to discuss this without some of the sexual nature of the charge and the facts before us, but I'll do my best to keep it clean. So it's May 2019 at Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, and there is a command inspection of the dormitory on base. So the dormitory, Airman Roach's dormitory specifically, is kind of a common living space with like a shared bathroom and then two private bedrooms. So there's a morale or health and welfare inspection, and NCO is going through the room, and in Airman Roach's bed, they find what can only be described as a very lifelike and realistic child sex doll. And what I mean by that is it is a silicone doll made to look like a prepubescent female child, kind of undeveloped body, about 4 feet tall. It was so realistic that the initial reaction of the NCO was kind of, you know, being shocked and stunned and fearful. And as OSI later responds and they see the doll for the first time, kind of a similar internal reaction of, oh my God, is this a real child? So it is, at least at first glance, a very realistic object. The doll itself contains like a speaker that, you know, battery operated and can make moaning noises if it's activated. And it has orifices that can be used for sexual purposes. So OSI is contacted and they respond, and there's some initial confusion over what to do, you know, in the situation. And ultimately they interrogate Airman Rocha. And so through that interrogation, we kind of get the story of Adele, which is the name that he gave the doll. So Airman Rocha bought this doll online from a website that sold sex dolls. It was shipped from China to a coworker's house off base. And he explained in his interview that he didn't think they would deliver to the dorms. And he also admitted that it would not be good to have something like this on a military base. So he had it shipped to a coworker and then brought it and stored it in his dorm. Now, there's no indications that he ever used the doll outside of the privacy of his dorm room or that it was used in any kind of a common room or public setting. So he admits to OSI that it basically was a child sex doll, and he initially claimed that he only used the doll for non-sexual kind of companionship purposes. And the facts of this case are a little strange. He said he brushed its hair, clothed it, would talk to it, and watch TV with it. And then throughout the interrogation, he admits to more and ultimately admits to penetrating the doll with his penis on 3 occasions, and then kind of claims that he stopped with feelings of kind of a sense of guilt about the whole situation. So certainly an unusual set of facts. And when you read the facts, it's easy to see kind of two opinions that people could fall under when they think about this case. On one hand, this is essentially private masturbation with an inanimate object. On the other hand, that inanimate object is shaped to look very realistically like a child. So he is ultimately charged with indecent conduct under Article 134 UCMJ, And there's an additional charge of possession of child pornography that he's ultimately acquitted of, so there's not a lot of details in the appellate record about that. Instead, most of the developing issues focus on constitutional issues surrounding the charge, which, interestingly, he was not charged with, you know, any kind of possession. The charge was for indecent conduct, for engaging in sexual acts with a sex doll with the physical characteristics of a female child. So the questions that this raises are constitutional in nature, based on the private sexual activity, and it creates a pretty interesting set of issues for the appellate courts that are not really even resolved by the CAF opinion.
Right, because so at trial, he originally makes a challenge based on that private consensual sexual activity, right? So he makes a motion to dismiss saying, hey, this is protected behavior, and traces that back to a case from 2003, Lawrence v. Texas, which isn't a CAF case. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case, which really talks about the sanctity of the adult consensual activity that happens in the bedroom. And the case raises from there in an interesting way. The judge obviously denies that motion because he's ultimately convicted, and that's why we're at CAF, because there's a conviction behind it. But the CCA reverses for a completely different reason. They reverse because they feel that the accused was not put on fair notice of the criminality behind his otherwise criminal behavior. So he wasn't put on fair notice of what was wrong about his conduct, which is required by the Fifth Amendment. And that's the question that the CAF is looking at today. Specifically, they frame the issue as whether the presidentially enumerated Article 134 UCMJ offense of indecent conduct provided appellee with constitutionally required fair notice that committing sexual acts, the child sex doll, was subject to criminal sanction. So we have the trial court convicting, the Airfort Court of Criminal Appeals reversing because of that notice issue, and now we're squarely in front of CAF on that fair notice question once again, a different question that was raised at the trial level. So what does CAF do ultimately with this one, Corey?
Well, CAF in a 3-2 opinion reverses the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Now, I think important to emphasize here that because the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals decided this case on notice grounds, they did not address the Lawrence issue at all. So CAF before it really only has the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals determination as to whether Airman Rocha was on fair notice when he committed the offense that his conduct was unlawful. And there is some relationship between the argument made at the trial court that the charge failed to state an offense because it was constitutionally protected conduct and the specific argument on appeal that we're talking about, the fair notice issue, in that if you believe you are engaging in constitutionally protected conduct, it is not unlawful. Therefore, the statute doesn't put you on notice that what you're doing is a crime. So there is an argument that there's a relationship between the trial argument and the appellate argument that's advanced. Ultimately, though, it's not effective based on the outcome of the CAF case.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because Judge Olson, who writes for the majority here, Chief Judge Olson, who writes for the majority, really starts off by talking like, hey, we're in plain error land once again. And I know if you listen to this podcast, like over the last few months or even during since its inception, you know that we talk a lot about what the standard of review is. And ordinarily, we're talking abuse of discretion a lot of time where the judge has made a decision and the appellant has to overcome that on appeal. But here we're in plain error because Chief Judge Olson points out this issue wasn't really raised by him at the lower court. It's a different thing, though related, like Corey pointed out, to say, hey, this is constitutionally protected conduct that I'm doing behind the privacy of my own bedroom versus, hey, I didn't know my actions were wrong because this didn't provide enough notice. So they're looking at this from a plain error standard. So good and important to think about from the outset when we're talking about this. And they lay out here, notice is really the touchstone of a fair trial. So it's whether or not the accused is aware of what he or she did is wrong. So in the language they're looking at and what they're really trying to determine is whether standing alone or as construed made it reasonably clear at the relevant time that the defendant's conduct was criminal. So whether or not it was reasonable for them to think what they were doing is wrong. And when they do that, they look at 134 in particular, Article 134, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's really a unique thing. So 134 is just a really broad general statute. So anything that is either prejudicial to government discipline in Clause 1 or of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces in Clause 2, anything there is potentially criminal if you look at just the statutory language. It's just what CAF's always going to look at first, and we've seen that time and time again. But what's happened over the course of history and what's made that not unconstitutionally vague and too broad is that the president enumerates specific things that he has decided either meet this definition or further define what can be criminalized here. And Chief Judge Olson goes through that quite particularly in, at the beginning of his opinion. So he first states off, like, these enumerations and explanations, one, are not binding on the court. We've seen in previous cases, United States versus Brown is one that sticks out in my mind, that the CAF will give more deference to the president if they're narrowing the scope of a statute, which is what the president's really doing here. And then second, they indicate what I just talked about, is the president's not creating a new offense when he enumerates something through Article 134. He's just providing examples of what kind of misconduct meets these broad, kind of ill-defined definitions. They're saying this is what is meant by Article 134, either in Clause 1 or Clause 2. The court makes the determination that the president can provide notice to an accused by making these enumerations in Article 134. So the president's enumerating offense of indecent conduct in 134, so they can look to that when they're determining whether or not Airman Rocha was on notice. So what did they have to say about indecent, Corey, in this particular case, since we know that they can rely on that? So what did they have to say about that particular offense here in this instance?
Well, there's a little bit of history involved with that question. So up until 2007, Article 134, one of the enumerated offenses, was indecent acts with another, which prohibited, obviously, public indecent conduct or indecent conduct in the presence of another person. That was eliminated in 2007 and replaced with the enumerated offense of indecent conduct. And so that prescribes engaging in indecent conduct under circumstances that are either prejudicial to good order or discipline or of a nature to discredit the armed forces. And important to this is the definition of indecent, which is a form of immorality related to sexual impurity, which is grossly vulgar, obscene, and repugnant to common propriety, and tends to excite sexual desire and deprave morals with respect to sexual relations. So that's, a long definition of lascivious conduct that tends to excite or incite sexual desire and depravity with respect to sexual relations.
Yeah, and it's interesting here. Judge Olson talks about, he says it pretty plainly, quite obviously this was indecent in this context. He had bought a realistic silicone-based child sex doll and admitted to penetrating it with his penis on at least three occasions. And he goes on to say, like, looking at any community standard, looking at that broad definition of what indecent is, that that's going to meet it in this instance. And the accused would have been on notice that his conduct was indecent and met the definition that the president enumerated for Article 134 here. So Airman Rocha's words kind of sunk him in this instance and led to that conclusion. Case isn't over, though, because ultimately, while the court says that the accused was on notice, they do send it back down for the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals to determine whether or not the accused had a constitutionally protected liberty interest under that Lawrence standard that he raised during the trial court. And we'll see what the CCA has to say about that. Interesting issue to think about, but we'll just kind of have to see where the CCA comes out about that.
I agree, and I'm really interested to see how this case develops further, because Lawrence, while it does not apply to every kind of sexual behavior, Lawrence very decisively recognizes a liberty interest in the privacy of your own home to engage in sexual conduct, at least with other persons. Now, there's factors that can quickly take conduct outside of that liberty interest, such as, the presence of a minor, prostitution, non-consent, things like that, or specific military nuances that could remove conduct from the protected liberty interest identified in Lawrence. And it remains to be seen, although at least in the dissent in Rocha, the Judge Johnson, I believe, kind of telegraphs that he believes this would have been protected conduct under a Lawrence analysis. But the full analysis of that and the appellate record is yet to be developed on it. So we're going to, stand by with interest to see how this plays out.
Yeah, and I think that that's interesting to note. So the two dissents here, and Judge Johnson in particular, really goes into quite a long analysis. Like, her dissent is 17 pages, I think, on the slip opinion. She really is highlighting that, one, she didn't believe that this was fair notice to begin with, because it is, like, as she puts it, like, it's basically just masturbatory behavior behind closed doors in the privacy of his own barracks room. Like, he's not really engaging in anything that's vulgar or immoral. It's just the use of some sort of masturbatory aid. And she does think that there's some sort of protection here. And Judge Hardy does side with her on that. He signs on to that dissent, and that's what creates the 3-2 split. I think also, interestingly, Judge Hardy writes separately dissenting and talks about, we're not talking enough about that terminal element in Article 134. So he points out that the government here charged of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces, but yet that they presented no evidence of that. Fast forwarding in time, there's a case pending in front of CAF right now that will decide how much evidence you need to present to satisfy that element. But he points out the precedent that exists now, they're just talking about the nature of the conduct and saying that's of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces, may not be workable anymore given the nature of military practice and having to prove that element beyond a reasonable doubt. So super interesting to see where that goes in particular. But the dissents are worth a read here, especially if you're going to challenge this type of misconduct going forward for these constitutional issues, if you have a case like this. Which brings me next to practice pointers for the field. I mean, this one's difficult to really say what to do for the field. I think that if you have a First Amendment type issue always, you have to be really well defined about what your objection is to it. Because here, the defense counsel made a really good motion. I mean, they said that this doesn't state an offense because it's constitutionally protected activity. But by not talking about and not saying the words lack of notice, they put themselves into plain error review on appeal. So being clear about what you're asking for during the trial level can shape the battlefield on appeal. Court, anything else you can think of for the field on this one?
Well, certainly the specificity in the argument at the trial level caused a lot of issues later. And when you look at the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals initially reversing the conviction and the split with CAF, this was a close call, yeah. Even with the error made at the trial level to the extent that they would say it was error. So specificity within the argument at the trial level, I think, is probably the most important. The other question that kind of remains to be resolved here, and is not clear from the appellate record before us, is how thoroughly litigated the Lawrence issue was.
Yeah.
So typically when Lawrence is implicated and potentially constitutionally protected conduct is charged, what are called the Markham factors are also typically pled, and they're a question for the members to resolve. So whether it is constitutionally protected conduct within the liberty zone, the zone of liberty identified in Lawrence, whether there's any factors that take it out of that the Supreme Court identified in Lawrence, and whether there's any factors, you know, that relate to the nuances of military life that are relevant. And because those are, you know, constitutional requirements, they're considered, you know, necessary elements of the offense when this is raised. So I don't know how well that was argued and litigated at trial, or if it was at all, and how that's going to play out with the appellate opinions. But it definitely one of the most interesting sets of constitutional issues I think we've seen for a while. And then I also just really enjoy reading this opinion, because it's one of those that when you read the majority, it's very persuasive. And then you read the dissents and they make really great points that are very persuasive. And it raises questions as to, you know, whether Congress maybe needs to, as often as they're amending the UCMJ, specifically create offenses for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think this is one to watch at the CCA. Like, typically we're just done when we're at CAF. But I think if you have cases like this, you're going to have to read Rocha in concert with whatever happens back down at the Air Force and maybe again at CAF. Who knows? Well, that about does it for this one. Thank you again for listening, as always. Please like and subscribe and rate us 5 stars. And until next time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.